This is Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Alex Chadwick. Opening this week at movie theaters across the country, Star Wars Episode III, Revenge of the Sith. This is George Lucas's final Star Wars movie, he swears. The last two of these Star Wars movies were well attended, but not really very well received. Some movie fans started looking back at the original Star Wars and saying about it what Gertrude Stein said about the city of Oakland. Maybe there's not much there there. Day to Day's Mike Pesca reports on what it means to judge a work of art based on the work that comes after it.
At about the midway point between the first and latest Star Wars films, creator George Lucas began to settle into his role as all-knowing master of consciousness, a taller, less green Yoda. This was the period when Bill Moyers taped a series of PBS specials with literary critic and folklorist Joseph Campbell. The set was Lucas's Skywalker Ranch, and the implication was that the appeal of Star Wars had deeply intellectual explanations. Then, with 1999's The Phantom Menace, Lucas put on display for the universe his storytelling virtuosity and mastery of mythic structure. And we got this guy.
The bosses would do terrible things to me. Terrible things to me if me going back there.
Jar Jar Binks, a bratty blonde kid in gobbledygook dialogue. The disappointing prequel was so far removed from the charms of the first Star Wars that the next in the series, 2002's Attack of the Clones, experienced a $120 million drop in box office. Sometimes sequels don't call into question the worth of a predecessor. The estimation of the first two Godfathers wasn't lowered by the third, and who even remembers that Chinatown had a sequel, The Two Jakes? But sometimes sequels do hurt the original, as in the Matrix trilogy. Audiences were so taken by the seeming complexity of the original Matrix that they presumed that there must be coherent background, says Eric Rabkin, a University of Michigan English professor who specializes in science fiction.
When two more movies come out and the coherence doesn't emerge, it becomes harder to maintain that notion that there's an obscure coherence that eventually we'll be able to see. So the sequels, in a way, made it harder for people to enjoy the original as an intellectual piece.
Sometimes subsequent works show the original to be merely formulaic, says Dennis Dutton, who teaches about the philosophy of art at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand.
I remember an artist named Walter Keane, who started back in the 1950s and 60s, doing paintings of little girls whose eyes were the size of grapefruits. And I think a lot of people who their first encounter with one of his paintings were struck by them, the supernormal eyes. After you've seen two or three, you begin to see that it's actually just a formula you're being fed, and the first one looks a lot worse.
Of course, Agatha Christie and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle hold up well exactly because they masterfully execute a formula. Sometimes an artist works in the same mode all his or her life, but just one time strikes gold. Take Daniel Defoe, whose estimated 565 books and pamphlets other than Robinson Crusoe didn't much impress writer Willa Cather. That, according to Rachel Cohen, author of A Chance Meeting, Intertwined Lives of American Writers and Artists.
She felt that Daniel Defoe was somebody who just worked with one particular formula. He was just incredibly interested in how people made their living. And there was one moment where that was really interesting to a reader also, which was when that person was on a desert island. But otherwise, it's not that interesting.
But Robinson Crusoe is still obviously regarded as a masterpiece. Moll Flanders has its fans too, by the way, just not Willa Cather. In yet another field, Arthur Miller wrote more than a dozen plays after Death of a Salesman. Some were good, most are hardly ever produced anymore. But Salesman is still seen as an out-and-out masterpiece. It could be that an author, especially a writer of serious drama or literature, has more endurance than a filmmaker, especially a director of blockbusters. Perhaps, suggests Eric Rabkin, there's something about the spectacle of motion pictures that clouds judgment in the first place.
When you see a visually stunning movie like the first Matrix, there's a leakage. You can't really, if you just examine the plot and the premises intellectually, conclude that there's a coherent philosophy behind it. But it is so stunning that you're willing to grant that the expertise that produced this must extend to all other aspects of the movie.
But there is no industrial light and magic technology for things like dialogue and convincing performances. The latest, Revenge of the Sith, has been getting good reviews. The New York Times called it better than Star Wars. which indicates susceptibility to the Jedi mind trick that George Lucas may be pulling. Create a cultural phenomenon, desecrate said phenomenon, and voila, you've set expectations lower than the pit of Carcoon. And after you've grossed literally billions of dollars, the artistic assessments become somewhat beside the point. Mike Pesca, NPR News, New York.